NYU, a think tank dedicated to improving governmental decision-making. Professor Revesz is one of the nation's leading voices in the fields of environmental and regulatory policy, and his scholarship focuses on the intersection between administrative law and environmental regulation. Professor Livermore is an associate professor of law at the University of Virginia Law School. Professor Livermore received his undergraduate degree from SUNY Albany and his law degree from NYU, where he was a Furman Scholar. After law school, he spent a year as a fellow at NYU Law's Center on Environmental and Land Use Law before clerking for Judge Edwards on the D.C. Circuit. After spending 5 years as the founding executive director of the Institute for Policy Integrity at NYU, Professor Livermore joined the faculty at UVA, where he focuses on environmental and administrative law. And we have three distinguished commenters on this article today. The first is Bob Martineau. Commissioner Martineau was selected by Governor Bill Haslam as Commissioner of the Tennessee Department of Environment and Conservation in January of 2011. He received his undergraduate degree from St. John's University in Minnesota and his law degree from the University of Cincinnati. He has spent 25 years practicing environmental law both in private practice and in public service, including 7 years in the Office of General Counsel at US EPA. He is head of the department that is the chief environmental and natural resources regulator for the state of Tennessee. And in August of 2014 was elected president of the Environmental Council of the States, a group representing heads of state environmental agencies. To his right, Mr. Gary Guzzi is currently senior of counsel at the law firm of Covington and Burling. Mr. Guzzi received both his undergraduate and law degrees from Cornell University before clerking for Judge Tuttle on the 11th Circuit. Mr. Guzzi served as general counsel of the US EPA and counselor to the EPA administrator during the Clinton administration, and recently served as deputy director and general counsel of the White House Council on Environmental Quality in the Obama administration. And last but certainly not least is Ms. Sally Katzen, who is currently a professor of practice and distinguished scholar in residence at NYU Law and senior advisor at the Podesta Group here in Washington, D.C. She graduated from Smith College and received her law degree from the University of Michigan Law School, where she was the first female editor-in-chief of the Law Review. She clerked for Judge Wright on the D.C. Circuit and has served in both the Carter and Clinton administrations. In the Clinton administration, she served in several roles involving economic and regulatory policy, including OIRA Administrator and Deputy Director of the Office of Management and Budget. She served as head of the Agency Review Group for the Obama-Biden Transition Team and has also served as a partner at Wilmer, Cutler & Pickering and has taught in both undergraduate and at several law schools. Thank you so much for being here today, and we look forward to hearing all of your comments.
Well, thanks so much, and of course, thanks to ELI and Vanderbilt and the folks at Vanderbilt for inviting us, and of course, to our commentators. One of the, you know, really fun parts of being an academic is when someone actually reads your paper, much less actually engages with your scholarship in a serious way. I'm going to do the way Ricky and I have allocated responsibilities is I'll provide the presentation. Ricky will reserve the real firepower for the response. So in our paper, what we're doing is we're basically examining different types of standard setting criteria for environmental standards with an emphasis on health-based standards, and in particular, we use kind of as an extended case study the NAAQS program under the Clean Air Act. Right? So there's, you know, we kind of set this up by identifying three general types of environmental standards. So there's health-based standards, sometimes referred to as no-risk standards or eliminate the risk standards, or identifying an adequate level of risk. And these kinds of standards are prolific throughout environmental law. These are very common approaches to setting environmental standards. And the most prominent example of a health-based standard is the National Ambient Air Quality Standard, arguably the most important standard setting process in all of environmental law. Okay, so in addition to health-based standards, you have other approaches that are also prominent. So the second that we talk about briefly, but isn't the focus of the paper, is a feasibility-based standard. Feasibility, also sometimes referred to as technology-based standard, right? So under a feasibility standard, the idea is to reduce a risk as much as possible, subject to some economic constraint, kind of roughly stated as don't bankrupt the industry, right? So the idea is force technology, go out and identify the most protective technology, again, with a rough economic constraint. And a third general type of standard is cost-benefit analysis, some kind of weighing of costs and benefits. And you could go within the general cost-benefit framework, of course, you can move from highly technical, formalized approaches to cost-benefit analysis to more informal cost-benefit balancing, where you might consider a range of different factors. Okay, so these are the three different standards, and we're, again, going to focus on health-based standards. So in the paper, we're going to identify two general problems that we find with health-based standards. Okay, the first we refer to as the stopping point problem, and the second we refer to as the inadequacy paradox. Okay, so the stopping point problem has been identified before, but we add in the extended paper, we add some flesh to the bones of some of the critiques that had been made around the stopping point problem in the past. And the inadequacy paradox is really, that's something that folks haven't really identified, and we spent quite a bit of time in detail discussing the inadequacy paradox. So our major kind of contribution on the stopping point problem is to identify in a class of cases where it wasn't obvious that it existed before. So the stopping point problem is this. If the only criteria that a regulator is using to develop a standard is to reduce a health risk, for example, it's not clear why at any point one would choose a less protective standard when there's a more protective standard that's available. Okay? Again, the conceit here is that the only thing that the regulator is supposed to take into account is reducing the risk. Now, there, in theory, was a natural stopping point for some types of contaminants. There was thought to be in the context of thresholds. So in the case of non-threshold pollutants, it's obvious, somewhat obvious at least, why the stopping point problem is generated. Because with a non-threshold contaminant, let's take particulate matter, if you reduce particulate matter exposure somewhat more, and it's a non-threshold pollutant, then you will reduce public health risks. Okay, so if you reduce exposure, you're going to reduce public health risk. And if the only thing that you are supposed to be taking into account is reducing public health risks, why not adopt the more stringent standard? Okay, so that's kind of, it's somewhat obvious in the non-threshold contaminant context, and others have identified this. But we spend some time in the paper going through the context of threshold contaminants, right? So we look particularly at the lead standard, the earlier lead standard. Nowadays, EPA assumes that lead is a non-threshold contaminant, but in the past, the agency has assumed that lead is a threshold contaminant. But nevertheless, there's a great deal of uncertainty around when that threshold is, how you set a nationwide standard, a nationwide average standard that's going to be protective of people within that threshold. There's questions about which group of people is the target group that one wants to identify to analyze the threshold. Okay, so let me just give some examples. So if you take children under the age of 5, it's very possible that you're going to develop a different threshold than if you take children under the age of 2, or if you take prenatal exposure. Okay. Nationwide averaging. Okay, so let's say that we identify a threshold of 15. Let's just say 15. We'll do this in a non-technical way. Okay, so we identify a threshold of 15 parts per million in the air. We don't want people to be experiencing an exposure of greater than 15 parts per million. But the thing is, what we're going to do is we're going to set a nationwide standard, and there's going to be averaging there. And we understand that there's a distribution, there's going to be, in reality, a distribution around the actual standard that's set. So if we set a standard of, let's say, 10, given the variance around that that distribution, we might know that 95% of people will be protected from getting an exposure of 15. But we're still not protecting 5% of the population. If we set the standard at 7, maybe we protect 99% of the population, but we're still not protecting 1% of the population. And this kind of extends forever, right? So again, even with a threshold contaminant, you can continue to protect public health even more by setting a more stringent standard. So the question is, how do regulators actually set standards in these cases? What we argue, and I suspect controversially, is that what regulators do is they intone the words public health judgment. But our claim is that that inquiry doesn't have a heck of a lot of content, or at least it's not obvious to us what that content of that is. And what our concern is that the only thing actually that could be informing the agency's judgment is something on the other side, that there has to be something on the other side, or else you would always just go with a more stringent standard, and that something on the other side is cost, what the agency isn't supposed to consider, and so what it ends up doing is obscuring the real grounds for its decision. Okay, so that's the stopping point problem. Now, onto the inadequacy paradox. So the claim in general with public with health-based standards is that they are more protective than using cost-benefit analysis to set regulatory standards. That's a widely held belief that is repeated in law reviews and actual real people in the world think this. So we were curious about this. And what we did was we looked at the regulatory impact assessments that were done for the most recent round of NACs for each of the contaminants, except for CO, because there was no fully fleshed out RAA. So the background thing here is that the agency, even though it's not supposed to take cost into consideration when setting the NACs, nevertheless actually undertakes a cost-benefit analysis kind of on the other side. So there's a group over here that sets the NACs, and there's a group over here that does a regulatory impact assessment where costs and benefits are examined. And they're not supposed to talk to each other, and folks claim they don't talk to each other, and we believe them. But what we do is we go through and we look at the cost-benefit analysis that's done of the NACs, and we look at the standards that were set. And one of the things that is we find that's interesting is that in each of the cases that we examined, if the agency had adopted a more stringent standard than the one that it actually adopted under the health-based criteria, that there would be greater net benefits, then an even more stringent standard would be justified using cost-benefit criteria. Okay, so like I said, we did that for every case of the NACs, and that's the lead standard. You can just look at the bottom if you want. We've got the less stringent alternative net benefits, $1.6 billion. We've got the actual standard net benefits of, I think that's $1.8 billion. And then the more stringent standard, $2.3 billion. Okay? These are net benefits. That's benefits minus costs, according to the agency's own estimation. We do the thing, we do that same analysis with the most recent ozone standard, same deal. The more stringent alternative has higher net benefits and would therefore be justified under a cost-benefit standard. Okay, so what's the kind of takeaway from this? So one is our goal is to clear up misconceptions, what we view as misconceptions, around the relative merits of health-based standards versus cost-benefit analysis. If it's the case that cost-benefit analysis would actually lead to more stringent standards, it's not clear why one would ever adopt a health-based approach, because the main justification for a health-based standard is that it leads to more stringent standards. And we think there's value just there in kind of pointing out this observation, because it's off, and again, to kind of counter the view that these large-scale economic or environmental regulations have negative net economic consequences, which in our view, at least according to the agency's analysis, doesn't appear to be the case. Secondly, we urge a reinterpretation of a very famous environmental law case, American Trucking v. EPA. And American Trucking was the case that held that EPA cannot take costs into consideration when setting the NACs. That's why they use the health-based approach. And what we argue is in that litigation, the entire context of the case was that if the agency were to use cost-benefit analysis, there would be less stringent standards. And so what we say is that the only holding of the case is that the agency cannot use cost considerations to adopt standards that are less stringent than the health-based standards that it would promulgate in the first instance. But the question has never been presented to the court whether the agency could use cost-benefit-based considerations to develop even more stringent standards than might be justified, to the extent that the agency has a justificatory standard for a health-based standard. Okay, so the idea here is you can depart in a more stringent direction using cost-benefit-based considerations, but American Trucking holds that you cannot adopt a less stringent standard than the health-based standard based on cost considerations. So just briefly before wrapping up, this kind of interpretation of American Trucking is, let's just say, it is intentionally controversial. Under existing political alignments, it's not surprising that many people would find this interpretation unsurprising, unusual. And the goal really is to kind of set a marker for a longer-term conversation about how we should read that case in particular, and more generally how we should be thinking about economic trade-offs in environmental law and the intersection of environmental law and cost-benefit analysis and economics more generally. Again, it's not surprising that folks find this unusual because it is a deeply ingrained view that cost-benefit analysis will lead to less stringent environmental standards. And our observation, based on APA's own analyses, is that that's not the case. It's not the case for any of the NACs. And so we need to rethink this relationship between cost-benefit analysis, health-based standards, and the Clean Air Act. Okay, so thank you very much. I look forward to the comments.
Good morning. Thank you, Professor. Thanks to ELI and Vanderbilt Law School for inviting me to be here and join this discussion. We keep talking about the academic world and sometimes the ivory tower and not being the real world, and then we talk about inside the Beltway. So I guess I'm the person out there representing the rest of the world in this discussion. And appreciate the thoughtful article. And having also been at EPA in the regulatory setting world, as well as working at the state level now and setting regulations there, but primarily implementing those federal environmental statutes and the permits and the regulations and how we choose to make those decisions. I think the authors really do a good job of pointing out that there really are sort of three basis is on which we have set our environmental standards in different regulatory programs, and they focus on NAAQS and the Clean Air Act, but whether you go to the Clean Water or TSCA or any of them, it's really, do you do a health-based standard, do you do a technology, or as they call a feasibility standard, looking at best demonstrated technology or various acronyms, reasonably available control technology, maximum achievable control technology in the air toxics program, or do you do some kind of cost benefit analysis, and where do those go? And obviously there are benefits and challenges or weaknesses with each of those approaches. And I'll just a brief comment on the American Trucking. I think I have a little bit of pause in the approach, and I'm glad you consider it controversial, but that you can use cost benefit to go more stringent but not less stringent, or that in EPA, the previous Supreme Court decisions in terms of setting NAAQS, that you can focus on cost. You don't focus on cost in setting health-based standards, but now you could do a cost-benefit analysis to do more stringent. I think that would probably take some kind of legislative change of statute, and of course we all know the likelihood of that happening. But it's an interesting discussion, and as you say, you know, do cost really sneak in through the back door in a more surreptitious way? In terms of looking at the comments and the advocating sort of the cost-benefit analysis, I'm going to look at each of these and sort of offer a slightly different view from my sort of trying to be practical perspective of actually getting regulations done and implemented. And as noted, the health-based standards, as we evolve science and technology and learn more about health impacts, we really are driving in most cases down to what either would be considered background or zero level. And everybody concedes that that's an impossibility. You're not going to get particulate matter out of the air completely. We have a manufacturing-based economy to some extent. We have vehicles that are going to move. You're never going to get to zero or to background. So We've got to find some way to set standards that are practical and feasible to implement that still generally protect public health and the environment. And that's the problem with the health-based standards, solely looking at that, is because you can always argue that there's going to be a health impact, and if you don't take any consideration into cost, you drive something that's ridiculous. If you look in a different context, you know, vehicle travel, we all concede that every year thousands of people will die in motor vehicle accidents. And we could, you know, you could simply say, let's not have motor vehicle travel, and we will eliminate those losses of lives, which are far greater than, you know, many of our environmental statutes in terms of the public health benefit. But we regulate speed, you know, we mandate safety vehicle, you know, put certain safety, seatbelt requirements and crash standards and you have speed limits to all manage that risk. But you, from a pure, if you set a health-based standard for something like vehicle travel, you would simply say zero, and we'd go back to riding horses, and okay, occasionally the buggy wheel came off and somebody fell in a ditch and got injured, but you would pretty much eliminate that risk, and that's thousands of deaths every year. When you do in the cost-benefit, the challenge in the cost-benefit analysis, in my experience, is you can fairly well, and obviously industry will always say the costs are going to be more than EPA projects, and EPA may underproject in many cases the cost of complying with the standard and putting on those technology controls. But you can kind of define it, and certainly over time, and even if it's technology forcing, and the costs tend to come out depending on the regulatory program. The acid rain program, industry thought that the costs were going to be astronomical and put everybody out of business. Every coal-fired plant would have to shut down the next day. And the cost came in at a fraction of what EPA or what industry thought, and it was actually implemented fairly well. And there's other programs that come out at a much higher cost. EPA thought the Title V program wasn't going to cost anybody anything to implement, and it cost, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars more than anybody ever thought. And that wasn't a health-based standard or something, but a regulatory program designed to improve environmental protection. The problem with the benefits, and I think, is where you always have a fight, and it's most subject to misunderstanding or numbers inflated, because how do you really monetize and put a value on, you know, one less sick day for a child, a case of asthma in a child, and the impact on that quality of life. And you know, and EPA talks about premature deaths when they're putting out NAAQS standards, is how many, you know, health things they're going to avoid. Well, first of all, if you could go back and actually look at what happens, you know, we've lowered our ambient air standard for ozone by almost half, so from 120 parts per billion now to 70. And we said each and every time that we're going to substantially reduce the cases of asthma from children. Well, asthma actually has gone up, so something's wrong. We're either not finding the right source of childhood asthma, or our benefits analysis was way off. It's one or the other. So, and it's always going to be putting the cost. So if you look at those numbers, I think a lot of people just look at those benefits analysis and kind of poo-poo them. Those are just statistical numbers. Somebody came up to put a monetized value on some quality of life thing. And that's always the problem when you have, you know, tort litigation. You're putting a value on, you know, what's the cost of somebody being injured in a motor vehicle accident and their life impacts down the road that they're trying to collect compensation for. So that's the problem I see with benefits, and you're always going to have litigation and you're going to breed it. So am I really looking back at the standards that I think have made a difference? Is you really look at the technology-based standards. And the authors are correct, and sometimes you over-regulate a little bit in that, and sometimes you may not regulate quite enough in terms of really getting at the public health protection. But if you look across the board, just look from 1970 to 1990, we got four or five or six health-based standards out in the air toxics program. Virtually paralyzed, got nothing done because we couldn't argue what the light level of risk reduction was, 10 to the minus 4, 10 to the minus 6, how did you quantify that? From 1990 on, we developed a technology-based standard after the 1990 amendments. And yeah, with the mercury air standard and a few, but lots of litigation. But primarily, those MAC standards have been put in place. They've put in controls. They've made significant reductions. And in this standard or that standard, it might have been a little over-regulation. There might have been a little under-regulation. But by and large, we got 90% of the air toxics out of the environment by doing technology-based standards. You look at the NSPS program under 111 until EPA decided to use 111D and go after coal-fired power plants. 111 was primarily a standard that set bases for new source standards for every industrial source category across the country, or across all industrial sources, and relatively little litigation and relatively easily implemented with little dispute across the country. And so my view is, if you're actually looking at how do you make environmental protection and public health gains, the technology-based standards are a lot easier to implement. You can figure out what the cost of controls are. You take another economic, or you create more water pollution than we're solving in air pollution, and you make a standard. And you can look at the technology. MAC says do top 12%. You know, you can kind of look at what that is. It's still got a technology forcing aspect to it, and it puts the regulation in place. So with that, I will stop and turn it over to Sally or Gary. Thank you.
Yeah. There are seats down front, and even though I teach, I will not call on you. I promise. So there are seats down front. I'm delighted to be here and to have been invited to participate, and I want to congratulate the authors who have produced an extraordinarily well-written, well-researched, and to my mind, careful and convincing debunking of one of the things that we have all lived with, which is health-based standards necessarily are more stringent, hence more protective of the than if you had considered economic considerations. And I think it is remarkable and praiseworthy that they provide facts rather than unsubstantiated rhetoric. So the information they've put together is new. It's dramatic, and I think it does address an important issue. But I was not invited to be a cheerleader. I was invited to provide comment. So I went through the article several times to see what it was that I thought was most important to at least raise for your consideration. I came up with two. The first goes to how standards are set. And we start, as Michael did, with this stopping point problem that he identifies. And they say that there is no coherent, defensible way for EPA to set the permissible level of a pollutant based on health considerations alone. And this is based on their premise that for a non-threshold pollutant, implementation of a health standard would mean that everyone that can be protected be protected, and that invoking public health policy judgments as the basis for a decision for stopping short of universal protection is essentially disingenuous, because they're convinced that the agency does use costs surreptitiously, but they use costs with the consequence that for adverse consequences for transparency, accountability, and the soundness of decision making. I see and have seen the decision-making process differently. Public health judgments, I do not believe, are limited to those in a laboratory setting. That's why they use the words policy and judgment. There may be more sense than specificity to the decision-making, but the fact that the decision is often more difficult to document than CBA, although, as we know, there are aspects of cost-benefit analysis that can hardly be called precise, does not make it any less valid. In our own lives, we often make decisions drawing seemingly arbitrary lines that are informed by science, but ultimately may be based on alternative criteria. Think about how you would decide how much contact to have with a family member with a suspected contagious disease. Informed by science, but maybe other considerations at play. In the same vein, medical doctors often opine about alternative treatments for a disease. Even when costs are not a consideration, there's still extensive deliberation because of the consistency or volatility of the data, the efficacy over time of different courses of action, and or the potential risks of the different choices. So not surprisingly, therefore, public policy decision makers routinely draw lines, wholly apart from cost considerations, regarding health issues, like the use of automobiles as opposed to shutting down all mobile sources, or putting warnings but not banning certain products like cigarettes or peanuts, requiring protective equipment, or approving drugs as safe and efficacious, even though adhering to the specified standard will leave some particularly vulnerable individual at very possibly serious risk. Now, with respect to the NAAQS process at EPA, Michael just talked about some of the bounds. At one end of the extreme is background. EPA cannot set it below background, even if sensitive populations may suffer adverse health effects. At the other end, there's even minimal exposure could likely lead to serious and irreversible harm, including death. Between those are multiple different levels where adverse health effects can range from low to high for different segments of the population, depending on a number of factors in addition to exposure. This is where judgment operates to determine whether to protect some, most, or virtually all of the population. And most importantly, this judgment is not exercised in a vacuum, but rather incorporates a number of factors to which the authors do not give a great deal of weight, such as the degree of uncertainty in the science, which in some cases can be very significant, or the ease of implementing the standard, which is a relevant consideration since we're talking about regulations that have to be implemented to have the desired effect. Now, the authors take a somewhat different, less complicated path, and I'm quoting from their paper, "Of course, if only public health considerations were relevant, less risk would always be better, and without considering the non-health consequences of a rule, such as compliance costs, there can be no justification for any decision to allow any risk at all." Whoa. That sounds a little bit like the precautionary principle, which has never been read into the Clean Air Act and doesn't square with most of our regulatory state, where decision makers are frequently facing the question, how much risk is acceptable? That's the essence of public health policy debate, and the answer is what I understand to be a public health policy judgment. It does have substance, and it's not simply a guise for secretly considering costs. And my view on this is admittedly biased or informed by my own experience in policy deliberations, including specifically the debates that took place in 1997 with the setting of the NAAQS for ozone and fine particulate matter. The authors assert we had to consider costs. Well, they're partially correct, for we did consider costs for the implementation stage. But before we focused on the implementation and what it would take to make these standards real, what would the feasibility be done recognizing the technology forcing purposes of the act, we had to take the first analytical step. And that was setting the standard. And at that point, costs were not a consideration. I would say it differently. In 1997, during review of the final rules, our conversations were bifurcated. What does the science say about what the appropriate level And having achieved the appropriate, having determined what the appropriate level should be, only then what's realistic about an implementation schedule. It's my recollection. Others may see it differently. Be happy to take questions on that point. My second point relates to the Whitman case and whether it's a bar to the use of cost-benefit analysis in setting standards if the use is confined to setting a level that is more protective than that which would result from a health-based standard. In other words, the author's suggestion that you can use CBA as a one-way ratchet to tighten but not to loosen a standard. So I believe in cost-benefit analysis, shockingly, and am convinced it's a valuable, though not dispositive, factor in decision-making. However, to say that American trucking can be reinterpreted to allow consideration of costs for the setting of the standard, even a more stringent standard, is a true testament to the author's ingenuity, but a very heavy lift. My admittedly unimaginative reading of that decision is that EPA cannot consider costs in the setting of an NAAQS under the terms of the Clean Air Act. None of the justices who wrote opinions even hint that given the statutory language, costs can be considered in setting the standard, including Justice Breyer, who's a consistently strong supporter of cost-benefit analysis whenever he can urge its adoption as a tool in decision-making. Now, the authors may well be correct that the justices assumed that cost-benefit analysis would yield a standard that would be less productive than one derived solely by health considerations. And based on the data and analysis they have assembled, that assumption was apparently unwarranted. That happens. Similarly, it's likely that in enacting and amending the Clean Air Act, Congress assumed that health-based standards would be more protective than those incorporating economic considerations. Indeed, as the authors note, that's been the longstanding view of both environmentalists and industry, and they don't often agree on a lot. So Congress probably did write and rewrite a statute based on a mistaken impression. Again, that happens. The solution is for Congress to correct its mistake. If Congress continues to want the EPA to set the most protective standard and can be convinced that cost-benefit analysis can, in some instances, militate in favor of a more protective standard than the one based on health, it should amend the Clean Air Act. Now, I recognize, standing here on Capitol Hill, that is extraordinarily unlikely for this day and age. But it's not for courts to rewrite a statute or read into it something so at odds with what Congress thought it was doing and what it did, even if mistakenly. And that would be not only beyond the ken of any textualist, if you go into statutory interpretation, but even the most devout purposivists, which I can never pronounce. I've always hated those labels. With the energy and enthusiasm that the authors bring to the subject, along with the incredible array of data and analysis they have assembled, they may persist and they may prevail. It's a worthy effort, and at the very least, the work they have done will shake, if not shatter, our conventional wisdom, which is always a good thing. Thank you very much. I had a sneak preview at Gary's paper, and this is industry's greatest nightmare. Someone from OIRA background agreeing with someone from EPA.
Well, what a pleasure to be part of this discussion, to have such wonderful fellow panelists who I've had an opportunity to work with in a variety of ways over many years, to have such a well thought through and provocative paper on such an essential topic, and to have it in this setting. So congratulations to the students at Vanderbilt, to ELI and the law school for really a tremendous convening. I want to focus on, I think, three aspects of the discussion, some of which has been touched on, some of which may be new, and talk about, first, what is it about the current structure of the statute that works and is so important, or what, in fact, could benefit from this very important insight that cost-benefit analysis shouldn't always be assumed to be necessarily less stringent than a health-based standard. Secondly, to look at this question, is there something, you know, sort of mysterious, nefarious, I think the authors say, a dark and ominous presence when they think about the role of costs and benefits in this standard setting? And then lastly, to just think about, if one wanted to accomplish a change like this, how could you do it under the constraints that currently exist under the existing law? Is there any basis for supplanting health-based standards? In thinking about the Clean Air Act, it's really, I think, important to understand how fundamental and almost revolutionary this structure is of setting basic health-based standards that then guide the rest of the enterprise, that set the baseline, that set a level of aspiration for our society. So when the Clean Air Act, the modern Clean Air Act, was adopted in 1970, when it began to impose upon the federal government instead of states this obligation, the process that it uses is to set protective public health standards based upon the best available science, to recognize that these, in fact, may change because we'll get more information, we'll get more science, we'll engage in periodic reviews, and to recognize the obligation of that review, to then force, through the setting of those standards, the development of technology that could help to implement those standards, and then lastly, to allow for flexibility in implementation so that the most cost-effective means of implementation can be found. And I think that in the context of certainly the Whitman versus American Trucking case, in many ways it began to seem like, particularly for a non-threshold pollutant like ozone, that EPA was driving further and further in terms of regulation, and that there were concerns that there might be some real costs that would be prohibitive that came from a number of the public discussions. And as industry sought to appeal this case, it raised those concerns and in particular focused on some of the thoughts that Justice Breyer has brought to the fore in his very important essay about breaking the vicious circle, about the challenge of going further and further in achieving reductions and the costs that result from it. But what is really striking, and I commend everyone to look at, in particular, his concurrence, where he talks about the fundamental role of technology forcing. And I would commend to the authors that they really think about the way in which technology forcing informs the cost-benefit enterprise. And remember, the industry had said, look, we're going to have to shut down an auto industry because we can't afford catalytic converters. And what Justice Breyer says in looking back over the entire legislative history, he says that the 1970 amendments were expressly designed to force regulated sources to develop pollution controls that might at the time appear to be economically or technologically infeasible, but in fact those hopes had proved realistic. He said, the Clean Air Act's technology forcing objectives makes regulatory efforts to determine the cost of implementation both less important and more difficult. It means that relevant economic costs are speculative because they include the cost of unknown future technologies. It also means that efforts to take costs into account can breed time-consuming and potentially unresolvable arguments about the accuracy and significance of those cost estimates. Congress could have thought such efforts were not worth the delays and uncertainties that would accompany them, and by that I think he also meant the years of potential litigation. In any event, that's what the statute's history seems to say, so said Justice Breyer. And I really think that that's a fundamental and important insight, which is, you know, there's been a lot of discussion about challenges of quantifying benefits like lost school days or lost IQ points, distributional concerns about who bears the cost, the public and the recipients of pollutant in communities versus a firm that might not be internalizing those costs. The idea that at times it's right, you know, think about the situation in Flint, Michigan, that the government just should regulate as a moral imperative. But this issue, this recognition of the role of technology forcing and how it makes cost-benefit analysis less important in some ways and harder to do, and it's been proven to actually work under the Clean Air Act, I think is a really relevant and important insight. So let me echo something that Sally Katzen said about the role of costs and benefits in actually setting national ambient air quality standards. There's not, in some ways, I'm a little bit mystified about the idea that there's something secret going on, because when one looks at the public record that EPA compiles in each one of those instances, it cannot be more public about what the costs of implementation will be under its proposal. Puts out a draft regulatory impact analysis. It puts out a final regulatory impact analysis. I know the authors probably struggled in reading through the hundreds and hundreds of pages. I looked at fine particulates. It was a 500-page document that's in the Federal Register. EPA puts out a presidential memorandum frequently that urges flexibility and talks about how it will interpret costs and benefits going forward and costs of implementation on industry. And it might even put out a draft federal implementation plan and a state implementation draft plan or comments on how those should be thinking about costs and benefit issues. So in many ways, what EPA does is, as I think Sally Katzen said, a basic public health balancing. And what it will do is it will look at not some incoherent task of how do you determine an acceptable goal if there's no reference to health, but rather, and I again refer to Justice Breyer, he said, the statute's words authorize the administrator to consider the severity of a pollutant's potential adverse health effects, the number of those likely to be affected, the distribution of the adverse effects, and the uncertainty surrounding each estimate. And that's what EPA has done in setting these standards. It looks at where the bulk of the data is, where the bulk of the science is, how it affects the public, how it affects health, those things which are public health based, and that's part of the concept of public health itself. And the idea that you may have studies that aggregate around a certain particular effect and not have studies that examine others because of the idea that there's a periodic review. Every 5 years, more science will be generated. That's the idea of scientific inquiry. Let's look, let's assess, but let's not stop regulating and fight about this, you know, almost impossible to develop set of information about what those costs and benefits will be. Let me turn for a second to the proposal on Whitman versus American Trucking, which as I knew it when I served as general counsel at EPA, was actually American Trucking Association versus Browner. And one of the extraordinary things about the case was that it was the culmination of a very long, a very admittedly contentious rulemaking process. And when it got to the Supreme Court, it was very, very difficult and hard-fought litigation. In fact, the Supreme Court, the Court of Appeals, had ruled in a different prong of the case that's equally important that it was unconstitutional under Article 1, Section 1, the non-delegation doctrine, for Congress to have given the agency this much authority to set rules without a so-called determinate principle. And one of the things that I think is almost striking is the degree to which this idea, is there a coherent basis other than cost for saying the standards, almost echoes the kinds of arguments that were made around non-delegation. And ultimately, the Supreme Court reversed the Court of Appeals and found that those public health factors were legitimate bases for delegating to administrative agencies. So this was a monumental and contentious battle, but it occurred in the context of fights about whether legislation should pass with super mandates that would impose judicial review requirements for cost-benefit analysis, whether those should be strict determinative tests that would amend all of the environmental statutes, and a very, very contentious point. And one thing that was, I think, so extraordinary about Whitman was it was actually argued on the day of the presidential election in the Bush versus Gore election. So had a lot of atmospherics that I think informed it, let's just say, and the cacophony of the election process as compared to the quiet and consideration of the courtroom was quite striking. But given the constraints that emerged from the finding of the court on this prong, that cost-benefit considerations as a fundamental matter are not to be considered in setting the public health goals, but only in the implementation, I have a hard time seeing how one gets to a somewhat different interpretation. Admittedly, the considerations there weren't focused on the instances and that insight that cost-benefit could lead to more stringent regulation. But I'm reminded of that phrase that actually comes from the American Trucking case that Justice Scalia used, where he said that in talking about American Trucking, that Congress does not alter the fundamental details of a regulatory scheme in vague terms or ancillary provisions. It does not, one might say, hide elephants in mouse holes, and it's unlikely that Congress would hide this elephant in this mouse hole. So, as one thinks about the overall enterprise of an evolving set of protections through a statute that's designed to ratchet down on public health protections, I think another important area of inquiry is how does EPA retain and build its credibility in litigation before the courts? And this is, an absolutely fundamental set of considerations for an agency and for building public faith in environmental protection going forward. And I think it's not to be taken lightly the idea that the agency doesn't want to necessarily make every argument it plausibly could make in interpreting a statute when so much of the fundamental structure and such a clear decisional constraints have emerged from what the Supreme Court has guided the agency to do. And I'm reminded of another case where EPA, in trying to sort of shift out clear statutory instruction for regulating mercury and other air toxics from power plants, tried to use general provisions of the act that would allow some kind of trading of mercury, and the Court of Appeals in that instance equated EPA's logic with the Lewis Carroll's Queen of Hearts, and it said where EPA substitutes its desires for the plain language of the Clean Air Act. And so, this isn't necessarily wanting to promote the idea that EPA can put people through the looking glass or into some kind of a magical world. Rather, the most fundamental thing is to really think about how both the agency builds its credibility and we as environmental lawyers who, as Bill Ruckelshaus said, are obliged to rise above the smoky battlefield, think about how we help to build public confidence and credibility in the kinds of outcomes that are so important. So I really appreciate the insights that have been raised about the way in which the standard-setting phenomena fit together and really look forward to an opportunity to have some more dialogue around it. Thank you.
Thank you so much. I, too, am very grateful to the Environmental Law Institute, to Vanderbilt Law School, to the Environmental Journal students, and to the panelists here. It's quite an honor to get to have your paper read by anyone, but by three such distinguished people who are people, each of whom I've admired for a long time and who've been such distinguished public servants. It's also slightly strange to be on the cost-benefit side of a debate opposite not just an OIRA administrator, but OIRA Administrator Sally Katzen. I might be the only person ever to be put in this position as I stand up to give my comments. Okay, I will focus on four different things. One, public health, what public health means. Second, cost-benefit analysis. Third, transparency and the possible surreptitious use of costs. And fourth, American trucking, and in particular, Justice Breyer. These are all issues that have come up in the comments. I obviously can't respond to every point each of the authors made in the time that the students have allotted me. So first, in public health, I certainly believe that public health has meaning. I mean, I, for example, every morning when I get up, take a baby aspirin. I think a lot of people in my age group do. My doctor told me I should. I assume the doctor has a basis for doing that. And some public health judgment was made that middle-aged people like me who don't happen to be Olympic athletes or whatever would probably benefit from doing that. I don't question it. I do it every morning, and that's all fine. I think that kind of public health judgment has very little to do with the kind of public health judgment that we criticize in the paper. And here's the reason. Let's go back to the lead example. So the problem in setting the national air quality standards for lead is that most of the lead that people are exposed to does not come from airborne, is not airborne lead. It comes from non-air sources like kids eating paint chips in public housing. So EPA faced a problem, and the problem was, well, how do you sort of figure out how much people are going to be getting from non-lead sources so that EPA can set the appropriate standard for air sources, which is all the EPA could do, because it couldn't go out and regulate public housing, so that people actually have the right amount of lead or don't have more lead than is consistent with public health. So EPA had decided, as Mike pointed out, that 15, this number 15, was a safe level. Mike already told you that there was a tail lead distribution. It was 20,000 kids who were going to be left unprotected. So in making that judgment, EPA decided that 20,000 kids was the right number of kids to be left unprotected. Now then, it turns out that of that 15, most of it came from non-lead sources. And EPA had a study, and the study showed that around the country, the range of exposure to lead of lead from non-air sources ranged from around 10 units to around 14.4 units. And EPA decided to pick 12 as the number that it would use. And by picking 12, as opposed to 14.4, which was a number that it found in some parts of the country, it did end up with a standard that was five times less stringent than the standard it would have come up with otherwise. And it decided to leave people in parts of the country where the non-lead exposure was higher unprotected. So the public health judgment was a judgment of how many people to leave unprotected. It wasn't a judgment of how do you appropriately protect people who are exposed to a risk. And this is not, I mean, the lead standard is not an anomaly. EPA does this all the time. So some cases, they look at the 99th percent confidence level. That seems like a reasonable thing. And maybe that's a public health judgment. That's what you should do. But for other standards, they use a 98th percent confidence level. Never explain why they used one in one case and one in the other. Is that a public health judgment? I kind of doubt it, actually. Having come up with a standard, they then say that it's okay that the standard should be exceeded 3 days a year or 5 days a year. And maybe 3 days is the public health judgment, but in the next standard, it's 5 days. Maybe there is a very carefully done public health judgment around the 3 to 5 day choice. I really doubt that as well. On sensitive populations, there are always more sensitive subpopulations. So the public health judgment is to leave the more sensitive subpopulations unprotected. Where do you get a PhD that tells you that the right percentage of people to leave unprotected is X rather than Y? I don't think you can actually get a PhD in that discipline. I think you can get a PhD telling you that for a population as a whole, people over the age of 50 should have one baby aspirin a day. That kind of judgment is very different. On cost-benefit analysis, our paper is not really a defense of cost-benefit analysis. It's not an attack on cost-benefit analysis. And by the way, the National Ambient Air Quality Standards are an anomaly. They're pretty much the only area under the Clean Air Act where a cost-benefit analysis would not be used as a result of executive orders to justify standards. Maybe not, maybe it doesn't drive the precise number, but the standard has to be justified by reference to cost-benefit analysis. The reason that it doesn't happen for the National Ambient Air Quality Standards is because of American trucking. So this is not some big debate about whether cost-benefit analysis should be used in environmental law to set standards. It is. It is for most standards. So if there are problems with cost-benefit analysis, that's a problem, but that's not this paper, and it's a problem that we seem to have accepted. And by the way, we're going to get more of this. Just last year, the Supreme Court in the Matz case, in the mercury toxics case, decided that the words appropriate and necessary require the consideration of costs, potentially also require the consideration of benefits. And EPA, when I think 2 weeks from now, April 15th, it will come up with its remand order on the Matz case, will probably justify it in a whole number of ways, but it will have a cost-benefit-based justification, I believe. That would be my guess. On the surreptitious use of costs, I mean, I wasn't there, I don't really know, but there are people who we cite in the paper who were there, were close to there. I'll just mention two. One was Boyden Gray, he was White House counsel. One was George Eads, he was a member of the Council of Economic Advisors. And there are great quotes about saying, look, you know, if you think that we would make judgments on issues that are of enormous importance to the economy without taking costs into account, you're mistaken. Maybe those people were wrong. I don't know. But we did not purport to conduct independent research on that. We relied explicitly on statements that were made over periods of time by high-level officials in administrations of both parties. Lastly, American trucking. I wrote, I was a counselor of record on two different briefs, one on non-delegation, one on cost-benefit analysis, on behalf of 120 environmental organizations in the American trucking case, including the Environmental Defense Fund, the American Lung Association, basically most of the major environmental organizations. And like everyone else, I believed at the time that taking costs into account was going to lead to less stringent standards. Everyone did. All the briefs, all the amici, there were tons of them, all the justices, everyone believed that. Now, Justice Breyer, so Justice Breyer was sort of presented as this great fan of cost-benefit analysis who understood in American trucking that it was inappropriate. That's actually not correct. If you look at Justice Breyer's concurrence carefully, Justice Breyer did something extremely pernicious. You know, I'm already kind of out there as a co-author of a controversial paper. I'll make a controversial statement. Justice Breyer came very close to buying into this very pernicious notion that's often pushed by anti-regulatory forces that health trade-offs have to be taken into account. So this is the idea that if it costs too much to save a life, you're going to sort of kill more people because of the cost. There is absolutely no economic support for this. It's based on a correlation that does not have any causal link to it. And in fact, when good studies were done, they showed the causal link was something totally different, which was like people with better education have both better health and more wealth. Justice Breyer said, look, costs can be taken into account, but we have to protect public health. So if these health trade-offs, which he bought into this really terrible argument, if these health trade-offs would show that because of the cost, more lives would be lost, then we have to take those into account. So Justice Breyer was basically willing to take a totally deformed, incorrect, and scientifically unsupportable form of cost-benefit analysis as a way of making the standards less stringent, but was not prepared in that concurrence to take good cost-benefit analysis that follows all established protocols for cost-benefit analysis to make it more stringent. Okay, I would love to say lots more, but I'm told my time is up. Thank you so much.
Okay, so clearly it would be nice if we had another 45 minutes, because I have a feeling with this group we could just continue to have a wonderful discussion. I would like to get a couple of questions from the audience, and then to the extent we can continue the conversation, maybe go over the break a little bit, we'll do so. All right, I better call in Mike Vandenberg.
Can I exercise my prerogative? First, let me just say this is one of the best panels we've had. I think it's really exciting. It's exactly what we're trying to do, engage on these issues. As Sally knows, Lisa Bressman and I did a study several years ago, published in the Michigan Law Review, and Sally did a brilliant job responding to it. We did our best to try to respond to her response. But one of the things we found after interviewing the top Bush administration and Clinton administration officials is a comment by an official who said, I wish just one time OIRA had asked me to make a rule more stringent. And the reason I raise that is because I think one of the most provocative thoughts of this paper, which I'm really fascinated by and interested in, is that CBA could end up making standards more stringent. And I think certainly in theory it could, but I just have a suggestion, which is that you all do an empirical study and look at all the different situations in which OIRA has intervened with EPA and evaluate how many of them they have pushed EPA by using cost benefit to make a standard more stringent and how many less. And if you find an asymmetry there, use that to test out a little bit the difference between the theory that it could versus what's actually happening. So just a sort of an observation, and I don't know if that's something that might
come up in response. Well, go, Ricky, and then I'll say something.
Well, I mean, today is an important day in this world because a huge number of amicus briefs are being filed and Clean Power Plan and by the parties defending the Clean Power Plan, including by the Institute for Policy Integrity that Mike and I work with. One of the interesting things is that there is this number out there called the social cost of carbon. And if you were setting a standard to maximize net benefits, you would value the reductions in carbon dioxide by reference to the social cost of carbon. The imputed value assigned to reductions in carbon dioxide under the Clean Power Plan is lower than the social cost of carbon. So basically, the level of control that would maximize net benefits if you sought to maximize net benefits, you would end up with a Clean Power Plan that was more stringent than the current Clean Power Plan. And before people get very scared here, we're not making this argument in the D.C. Circuit. We're supporting the standard very strongly. But nonetheless, it is the case, and it has been noted in the literature.
Just really quickly, we make a distinction in the paper, and I think it's important to make a distinction between cost-benefit analysis and OIRA. OIRA is an institution. Cost-benefit analysis is a methodology. They're closely associated with each other, but they are different. And so our claim in the paper isn't that expanded role for OIRA would lead to more stringent standards. That may or may not be the case. We don't look into that question. What we're interested in is whether the agency, when using cost-benefit analysis, its own cost-benefit analysis, would have selected more stringent standards. So I do think it's important to draw that distinction.
Well, the other thing I would like to say on behalf of OIRA, which is an institution, although, yes, is that your study was with respect to people at EPA who have one type of relationship with OIRA, and there are other agencies that have other types of relationships, and so they weren't exactly looking at the universe of OIRA review and whether it has done effective review, because I am aware of instances where an agency has proposed something which has been very costly, and with a little tinkering, they get much more benefit for significantly less cost. And that kind of instance where you can use your resources most effectively and efficaciously is really what one of the things that you apply analysis to decision making to see if you're getting the biggest bang for the buck. The other thing is that with, as has been clear here, different programs are governed by different statutes and they have different criteria. And those, everything throughout Executive Order 12866 is subject to law, consistent with law. We're going to follow what the statute tells us to do. And so I'll shut up.
Gary, Bob, do you want to add anything? Maybe we'll take one more question. Other questions? Yeah. Oh, either one.
Or both.
Or, well.
I take a step back and think about why we think cost-benefit analysis is useful. And I think the answer to that is it is a disciplined way of thinking about the consequences of what you're about to do. And as we have learned more, I mean, I was at OIRA in the 90s. We've had almost two decades since then. And there's been a lot of work done in the fields of economics and other relevant fields. And as we learn more, we become more sophisticated, would be sort of a high-handed way of saying more knowledgeable about the consequences of actions as they are taken, and to array the various costs and to array the various benefits gives you a sense of what this is all about. It's a discipline imposed to make sure you think before you act. And one of the things that OIRA is often able to do is to say, have you thought about this, or have you considered that, or have you discounted this? And I don't mean in the discount rate, but I mean in terms of giving weight to it. And those are all put into a mix that informs decision making. And at least during the administration of the Clinton administration, I would say it's not dispositive. It's informative. It lets you know what the guideposts can be, and it helps you think through decisions. So rather than buying into a it's going to do this or it's going to do that, I think of it as a discipline in which you gather and then are informed by the information, and whether it's coming from the agency initially, and they should be doing that before they craft a proposal. I mean, if you do a cost-benefit analysis after you've done the final rule, excuse me, that is a total waste of time and effort. It's a paper process. It's not informative. But if you do it in the beginning and you get critiques on it, and people, you put it off comment, and people will say you haven't considered this or you haven't considered that, then that leads to, I think, good decision making. And as long as I've seized the microphone, I'm just going to say that with respect to George Eads served with me during the Carter administration, which was before 12866, but more importantly, before the Clean Air Act amendments of 1990. And Boyden Gray gets great credit for helping George Herbert Walker Bush craft the 1990 amendments to the Clean Air Act, which were fabulous from an environmentalist point of view. And maybe his comments reflect to some extent what he was seeking when he decided to help support health-based standards for the NAAQS.
All right, and if the gentleman has the last question, and then we'll wrap up.
I was in the room when PM, ozone, and SO2 were decided. I assure you, cost considerations are not taken into account. Mm-hmm. In doing that, we take very much to heart the admonition in Whitman, or rather, it should be. shown to be considering those factors, it would be considered an impermissible factor and the rule vacated ipso facto. We do not consider this when making next decisions. I'm curious on, I didn't read the full paper, but just reading this paper, I don't see the words scientific uncertainty or CASE Act, the Clean Air Act, Scientific Advisory Committee even appearing.
Yeah.
Those factors set clear parameters on where we can make these public health judgments. On PM, well, the key epidemiological studies at the district, the key distribution showed a clear fall off in the quality of the data. That was a reasonable basis for that decision, for example.
Yeah. Yeah, actually, last summer we looked at all of the interactions between CASAC and the agency on each of the most recent national ambient air quality standards. One of the interesting things is that CASAC is this very fancy outside advisory board of very distinguished scientists. The agency actually doesn't always follow the recommendations, and sometimes the back and forth between CASAC and the agency people that doesn't make a lot of sense on either side. And on the scientific on scientific uncertainty, there's scientific uncertainty at all levels. Nothing is actually certain. And I'm not actually sure that the best way to make policy is to draw a line in the sand and say, we're just going to disregard all of this evidence. And then because the probability, because the uncertainty is above a certain threshold, but right on the other side, we will take it all into account as if it was unimpeachable. I mean, what would make more sense is to do an expected value analysis, which is actually probably the most widely followed decisional technique for dealing with uncertainty. The CASAC approach tends to be cut it off at a certain point, take things on one side of the line as being unimpeachable, things on the other side of the line as being worthless, and where that line is placed, somewhat hard to understand. But anyway, if the agency always followed CASAC, there might be a stronger claim because those are actually the experts, and that is not always the case, as you know.
All right, well, unfortunately, we need to wrap up, but please join me in thanking this panel for an excellent discussion. There are bagged lunches at the back of the room. Please grab a bagged lunch, and we're going to reconvene in about 5 minutes.
In the room. Like, there are lots of rooms.
Exactly. There are many rooms.